Today is Monday, December the 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Thank you for joining us. Coming up in the next half hour, Israel Prime Minister Naftali Bennett is in Abu Dhabi to meet Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan. It is the first time an Israeli Prime Minister has publicly visited the United Arab Emirates. British Foreign Minister Liz Truss said this weekend that the Group of Seven economic powers are telling Russia to, quote, de-escalate its military buildup near the Ukrainian border.
The most important thing is that we defend and advance freedom and democracy, and that is the main topic of the discussion at the G7 this weekend. We cannot have short-term economic gain at the expense of our long-term freedom and democracy.
And thousands of Lebanese now rely on local NGOs to provide their basic food needs, as UN agencies warn that almost three-quarters of the population are living in poverty. And the United Nations Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights is condemning the forced expulsion of asylum seekers and migrants by Libyan authorities.
Those expelled have often already survived a range of other serious human rights violations and abuses in Libya at the hands of both state and non-state actors.
The United States, Australia, Denmark, and Norway have announced an export control program to monitor and restrict the spread of technologies used to violate human rights. We'll have these stories and more coming up right here on International Edition. Stay tuned. And for our top story, as the two-day virtual summit for democracy hosted by President Joe Biden wrapped up on Friday, the U.S., Australia, Denmark, and Norway announced an export control program to monitor and restrict the spread of technologies used to violate human rights. The U.S. is also launching programs to support independent media and anti-corruption efforts and defend free and fair elections. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Widakuswara has more.
From robots patrolling behavior, facial recognition surveillance, to software that turns phones into spying devices. Such technology is often used by governments to target political opponents, activists, journalists, and minority groups.
We focused on the need to empower human rights defenders and make sure technology enables so much of our lives that is used to advance democracies, to lift people up, not to hold them down.
As the two-day virtual summit for democracy hosted by President Joe Biden wrapped up on Friday, the U.S., Australia, Denmark, and Norway announced an export control program to restrict the spread of technologies used to violate human rights. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
We've seen the expanded misuse of spyware and other surveillance technology to monitor citizens far beyond what's needed to fight the virus. We've seen the rapid spread of disinformation and misinformation.
The U.S. also announced initiatives to empower human rights defenders, support free and fair elections, independent media, and anti-corruption efforts. Transparency International, a global civil society organization working in the fight against corruption, said the summit's initial outcomes are promising, but more needs to be done. Gary Kalman directs their U.S. office.
Other countries did not step up and commit to specific commitments the way the U.S. has. And so that is a concern. What are they actually going to come up with? They have a little bit more time. The U.S. government's giving them until January to come back with commitments.
Some say the $424 million in U.S. funds for these initiatives, still subject to congressional approval, barely meets the need to bolster democracy globally. Brett Bruen is director of global engagement during the Obama administration and president of the consulting firm Global Situation Room.
These are initiatives and monies that have been allocated already generally for democracy, for the rule of law and human rights. They get to repurpose them for a new announcement. But what we're not seeing here are really substantial sums that are being put on the table.
Democracy is also under attack by the global rise of populism, white supremacy, and extremism, said UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
Polarization is undermining democratic institutions. Science and reason are under siege. All of this is eroding trust between people and democratic leaders and institutions.
An in-person summit is planned a year from now. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
President Biden is seeking to reassure Ukraine that his strategy to prevent a Russian military invasion will work. Amid continued tensions over a massive Russian troop buildup along their common border, VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
President Joe Biden spoke Thursday with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to inform him of his phone conversation earlier in the week with Russian President Vladimir Putin. The calls came as the U.S. and its European allies are stepping up diplomatic efforts to persuade Putin to step back from potential plans to invade Ukraine, with nearly 100,000 Russian troops amassed near their common border. Putin says he is not planning to invade, but that he is threatened by Ukraine getting too close to NATO, and that Russia reserves the right to defend its security. Zelensky said in a tweet that he and Biden discussed ways to resolve the conflict with Russian-backed separatists in Ukraine's Donbas region that has killed more than 14,000 people. At a Thursday news briefing in Washington, State Department spokesperson Ned Price said that in some ways, concerns over a potential Russian invasion are bigger than worries about the people of Ukraine. State Department spokesperson Ned Price.
What Vladimir Putin seeks to do is to rewrite the rules of the international order, is to circumvent the idea that small countries can't bully large countries, can't bully small countries, that a country can, at the barrel of a gun, redraw borders. That cannot happen. It must not happen in today's world.
It's now up to Putin to step back from the brink if he wants to hold talks about security in Europe. Former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Bill Taylor, told VOA.
He wants to talk about security, talks about European security. That's fine. You know, we'll talk about that as long as the Ukrainians are there, as long as the Europeans are there, because they're part of this discussion, clearly. But those conversations can't start until President Putin puts the gun down. You can't negotiate with somebody with a gun to your head.
Taylor said Ukrainians are still very concerned by the Russian military buildup on three of their common borders and by statements by Putin saying that Ukraine is not an independent nation. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Biden and his Russian counterpart held a two-hour virtual meeting last week amid escalating tensions after months of what analysts call Russian saber-rattling. British Foreign Secretary Liz Truss said this weekend that the group of seven economic powers are telling Russia to de-escalate its military buildup near the Ukrainian border.
What we've seen this weekend is a united front from the G7 that there would be massive consequences if there were to be a Russian incursion into Ukraine, which would carry severe costs.
That was British Foreign Secretary Liz Truss. And Russia denies that it intends to attack its neighbor to the west, saying that its deployment of around 175,000 troops was a training exercise. In their meeting, Putin decried the lack of progress by Ukraine in implementing the 2015 Minsk Agreement, which was meant to stop the fighting in the eastern region of Donbas. He also asked for guarantees that NATO military alliance would not expand to its border countries. The White House National Secretary Advisor Jake Sullivan said President Biden made no commitments or concessions on possible NATO membership for Ukraine. Julia Loff is a founding partner and Washington correspondent for PAC News. Julia has written extensively about U.S.-Russia relations, and she joins me via phone. I asked her if, in her opinion, Russia was actually planning to attack Ukraine or was Putin deliberately stoking fears about military action as a play to his home audience as he prepares for the 2024 elections?
I think that's the million-dollar question or the billion-dollar question. Is he planning on it? Yes, because we know there are plans. U.S. intelligence has picked it up. It has shared it with the Ukrainians, who at first were like, no, nah, he's just, you know, pulling our leg. And after the, you know, the American side gave it to the Ukrainians, they were like, oh, okay, yeah, this is serious. So, yeah, there is obviously a plan. And it's not just 100,000 troops that are on the border in three different places. It's also that they're calling up tens of thousands of reservists. It's also that they're reinforcing supply lines. So, you know, preparing for what could be a pretty long and drawn out conflict.
Mm.
The other question is he going to? Is he going to pull the trigger? And I think we don't know yet. People in Washington are really, really concerned. And they think it's going to happen either in January or in February. But I don't know. I know that Putin, you know, when he first invaded Ukraine in 2014, it was a very knee-jerk and last-minute reaction or decision. And we know that now because, you know, a few years have passed and people have come forward and talked about it. And even Putin himself has said it was, you know, a pretty last-minute decision. So that could be the situation here, or he's already decided.
Biden and Putin had that two-hour video chat. We don't know much of what the U.S. is prepared to do. They're kind of being ambiguous in, you know, they're talking about sanctions. Biden said that there won't be any boots on the ground. But what was the Kremlin's reading of how the summit went on their side? Did the summit, in essence, achieve any of their objectives on their part?
Well, it depends. So on one hand, they didn't get what they wanted because the U.S. did not, and NATO did not give them a guarantee that Ukraine would never be a part of NATO. That's just not something that the U.S. can give because it violates Ukrainian sovereignty, right? They should have the choice whether they want to join NATO or not. And that in itself, like an aside there is, it's funny because Ukraine's not going to join NATO. Like nobody in NATO wants this. Ukraine isn't ready. They don't want to exacerbate the situation with Russia, but they can't say it out loud, right? So it's a weird, he's like trying to call their bluff and saying like, say it, give me a legally binding guarantee. So he didn't get that. But he did get his second bilateral summit with Biden in 6 months. This is the fourth conversation he's had with Biden, and Biden has been in office for less than a year. I think that is also something he wants, to be treated as an equal, to be somebody who is feared and contended with, so that people have to go to him and take his concerns seriously and appease them and deal with them. And he said after the day after the summit, he said, I think our concerns were heard, and we're working on the assumption that our concerns were heard. Because there was a feeling in Moscow that Washington was just kind of laughing it off and not taking them seriously and not hearing and taking seriously Putin's concern, Russia's concerns. Mm. And so in that sense, he did get what he wanted.
So even the optics themselves of him, you know, having that conversation with Biden. Absolutely. In a way.
But I think it's more than the optics. It's that he is getting these long conversations. You know, like 2.5 hours of the American president's time is a lot of time. And, you know, Obama, who called Russia a regional power, which from what I hear infuriated Putin more than anything. Like he hit the roof when he heard that. He was more offended by that than when Russia got kicked out of the G8. And now Biden's calling him a worthy adversary. He's taken the time to talk to him. And it's not just the conversations between Biden and Putin. There are constantly very high-level conversations going on between Washington and Moscow. Our Secretary of State is talking to their foreign minister. The CIA director went over to Moscow for talks. Victoria Nuland went over to Moscow for talks. Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, went over for talks. Like, these are really high level meetings that show the Russians in substance as well as in the optics that they're a regional power if the U.S. is spending that much time on them.
That was reporter Julia Loff. She's the founding partner and Washington correspondent for PAC News. Julia has written extensively about U.S.-Russia relations. She joined me via phone here in Washington, D.C. Second part of our conversation later on this week. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Bunganyi. Israel Prime Minister Naftali Bennett is in Abu Dhabi to meet Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan. It is the first time an Israeli Prime Minister has publicly visited the United Arab Emirates. The issue of Iran's nuclear program is expected to be high on the agenda. Linda Gratstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
Prime Minister Naftali Bennett's visit was announced just hours before he flew to the UAE, the first time that an Israeli prime minister has openly visited Abu Dhabi. Before departing on his trip, Bennett said,
I'll be meeting with Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed. We're going to be discussing ways to further our cooperation in a number of fields, especially strengthening our economic and commercial ties. In just 1 year, since normalizing our relationship, we've already seen the extraordinary potential of the Israel-UAE partnership. And this is just the beginning.
Israel and the Emirates have long had close economic and security ties, but until just over a year ago, those ties were not public. Now, with the signing of U.S. brokered agreements known as the Abraham Accords, those ties have deepened even more. In 2020, during the administration of then-U.S. President Donald Trump, Israel, the UAE, and Bahrain signed the accords at the White House, normalizing ties between Israel and the two Arab countries. Morocco and Sudan later joined the accords. Israel's new ambassador to the UAE, Amir Hayek, says the meeting between the Israeli prime minister and the sheikh is historic.
The ביקור היסטורי, פגישה היסטורית בין שייח מוחמד בן זאייד, יורש העצר, לבין ראש הממשלה.
He said that the relationship between Israel and the UAE is a year-old baby who already speaks three languages, and there is a lot of excitement in the UAE about Bennett's visit. The Israeli prime minister traveled to the UAE with a small delegation and no journalists because of concerns about the Omicron variant of the coronavirus. The issue of Iran and its nuclear program is expected to be high on the agenda. Israel and the UAE share a concern about Iran becoming a nuclear power. The meeting in the UAE comes amid tense talks between the United States and Iran on a renewed agreement on Tehran's nuclear program, which would see sanctions on Iran lifted. Bennett has continued to take a hard line on Iran.
Iran deserves no rewards, no bargain deals, and no sanctions relief in return for their brutality. I call upon our allies around the world, do not give in to Iran's nuclear blackmail.
Iran maintains its nuclear program is for peaceful purposes. The territory of the UAE is very close to Iran. Iran as a nuclear power would pose just as much of a threat to them as to Israel. Bennett's visit is expected to deepen already close security and intelligence ties between Israel and the UAE. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
The United Nations Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights is condemning the forced expulsion of asylum seekers and migrants by Libyan authorities, warning of the risks many face when returned to the homes they fled to escape persecution. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Two large groups of Sudanese are among those forcibly deported from Libya over the past month. United Nations monitors say most have been summarily expelled from the Ganfuda and Al-Kufr detention centers. Both centers are controlled by the Interior Ministry's Department for Combating Illegal Migration. The monitors say the Sudanese apparently have been transported across the Sahara Desert to the Libya-Sudan border and dumped there. The UN Human Rights Office says Libya's expulsion of the Sudanese asylum seekers and migrants without due process and procedural guarantees violates international human rights and refugee law. UN spokesman Rupert Colville says the group of 18 Sudanese expelled Monday reportedly were arrested, detained, and arbitrarily expelled. He says no hearing was held to assess their need for protection from persecution, torture, and other abuse in their home country. He says they were not granted legal assistance.
Those expelled have often already survived a range of other serious human rights violations and abuses in Libya at the hands of both state and non-state actors, including arbitrary detention, enforced disappearance, trafficking, sexual violence, torture, and ill treatment.
Colville says other migrants from Sudan, Eritrea, Somalia, and Chad, including children and pregnant women, also have been detained in recent months. He says they either already have been expelled or are at imminent risk of deportation.
Now of immediate concern is the group of 24 Eritreans who are currently being held in the same Ganfuda detention center and who are believed also to be at risk of imminent deportation. On the 3rd of December, we were informed that in a pattern of mirroring the experience of the expelled Sudanese, they had been transferred to the Al-Kufra Detention Center in preparation for their deportation.
The UN High Commissioner's Office is calling on the authorities to protect the rights of all asylum seekers and migrants in Libya. It says they should investigate all claims of violations and abuse and bring perpetrators to justice in fair trials. It urges Libya to meet its obligations under international human rights law, which prohibits collective expulsions. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And in other news, in Kentucky, residents, many without power and water, worked on Sunday to salvage what they could in towns scarred by a string of powerful tornadoes that officials fear killed more than 100 people while obliterating homes, businesses, and anything else in their way. Authorities say that they had little hope of finding survivors beneath the rubble, but rescue workers continued to scour fields of debris. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. And remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our videos. Just search for VOA Africa. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. 6 years ago, nearly 200 nations signed the Paris Climate Accord, where they agreed to keep the rise in global temperatures at 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial times. Scientists say that threshold is an absolute minimum to avoid catastrophic climate change. And for VOA from Paris, Maria Gallivan looks at the situation now.
Our fragile planet is hanging by a thread. We are still knocking on the door of climate catastrophe.
As he wound up the recent COP26 in Glasgow, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres had that harsh warning for the 200 countries who had gathered to talk climate change and how to slow it down. Hanging over the summit was the deadline of 2030 for a drastic reduction of greenhouse emissions that was set 6 years ago at COP21 in Paris. Former Executive Secretary of the UN Climate Convention, Christiana Figueres, remembers it as a historic event.
It was a real breakthrough for the United Nations to have a completely unanimous, legally binding pathway for decarbonizing the global economy.
Secretary of State at the time, John Kerry, signed that agreement for the U.S.
It really was an exciting moment when 196 countries come together simultaneously, all wanting to move in the same direction, understanding the stakes.
2015 was the hottest year on record. Scientists pointed to that as sure proof that global warming was real and serious. But that record keeps on getting broken as the planet gets hotter year by year. The World Meteorological Organization says the planet has been propelled into uncharted territory with rising sea levels, melting glaciers, and relentless extreme weather events. The WMO warns that extreme weather is the new normal. Nonetheless, both Figueres and Kerry remain optimistic.
We are moving in the right direction. The question is the timing. And I do feel that everyone came out of Glasgow with a renewed sense of timing.
Kerry is now President Biden's special envoy for climate. He was back in Paris this week as part of a whistle-stop tour of Europe to reassure leaders the U.S. is back in the game after former President Donald Trump shut the door on climate issues.
No one country can save this. Everybody has to act.
That was also perhaps the main takeaway from the Glasgow summit, as developing nations pleaded with their richer country neighbors not to be complacent with what has been achieved, but to keep pushing hard to meet that 2030 deadline to save the planet. Maria Gallivan for VOA News, Paris.
New Caledonia held a referendum on independence from France on Sunday. It is the third and final poll meant to conclude a decolonization process that began in the French Overseas Territory in the Pacific 30 years ago. Two previous votes in 2018 and 2020 rejected independence. And from Sydney, Phil Masser reports.
Pro-independence groups wanted New Caledonia's referendum to be delayed to give indigenous Kanaks, who make up 40% of the population, time to grieve those who've died during the pandemic. Traditional mourning rites last a year. The group said COVID-19 has disrupted campaigning for the referendum and have called on supporters to boycott the vote. France, though, had said the referendum will proceed. It sent about 2,000 police officers to maintain security in its semi-autonomous overseas territory. Denise Fisher is a former senior Australian diplomat in New Caledonia and a visiting fellow at the Centre for European Studies at the Australian National University. She told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation a boycott by large numbers of voters would be destabilising.
We are talking about an agreement, a referendum under an agreement that made pledges to what were defined as a colonised people. And if you have those very people who are specifically recognised under the Namir Accord for their cultural identity and their legitimacy, if they are not going to participate in this third and final vote, especially when the last two were so close, it does undermine at least the political impact of that vote.
The 1998 Namir Accord followed a decade of deadly conflict in New Caledonia in the 1980s. And set out a path for potential independence. The South Pacific archipelago has the world's seventh largest nickel reserves. Mining is its major industry, but the territory relies on financial support from Paris. It has a population of around 270,000 people and is 1,500 kilometres east of Australia. Loyalist groups have argued that maintaining ties to France is vital for the territory's development. Analysts have said if New Caledonia does break away, it would further diminish France's status in the Indo-Pacific, at a time that neighbouring Australia has boosted its presence in the region with a new security alliance with the United States and Britain. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a great week ahead.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
The World Health Organization and Africa Center for Disease Control say we all can help fight the global pandemic by frequently washing our hands with soap and water or using hand sanitizers. For more information on protecting yourself and others, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa Center for Disease Control. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest on COVID-19.
They're still trying to figure out what are the specific policies from the White House.
VOA Asia, your daily digest of top Asia stories.
Beijing has especially hazardous levels of air pollution.
Blending American and Asian perspectives.
China is protecting wildlife.
Original reports and series. Education, health, technology. Stories that mean something to your daily life. VOA Asia.
Voice
of America, Washington, Baba.